Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all. This morning I'm going to talk about the three Dharma seals, which is a very basic teaching of Buddhism. And I think it's time to talk about this topic again. I haven't talked about it since 2006. It was the subject of my very first Dharma talk here. And by the way, I looked at that talk. Could I have just a little more light for Rue? Thank you. So, yeah. So I looked at that talk and I found something that I thought was kind of funny. In that talk, I was talking about impermanence, and I was talking about how things are really good, and we want to hang on to them, and then it's the process of trying to hang on to things that gets us in trouble. So I was talking about things that are good, and I said, we all have things we want to hang on to. Right now, things are very good at MZMC. I have a wonderful teacher. I have a place to come, and it's warm and friendly. I have my Dharma sisters, my Dharma brothers. I have a place in the world. I have meaning in my life. I want this to go on forever. I really do. If I can be sitting here in 20 years giving basically the same talk to basically the same people, I will be truly happy. So I guess I must be truly happy right now. It hasn't been 20 years, it's only been 13, but I'm in the same place, a little higher up, but talking about the same stuff, and to maybe a few of the same people. So I think it's good to be reminded of this. It's good to be reminded of how lucky I am to be able to do this, and how lucky I am to be able to come to Zen Center, and I feel a lot of gratitude, and I hope you all are feeling that too. This is a really precious thing that we have here. So the three Dharma seals are also known as the three marks of existence, also known as the three marks of the law. So I will probably talk about the three seals and the three marks interchangeably. It's the same thing. We have many lists in Buddhism. As you know, Buddhism is about one thing, here and now, but we have about 10,000 different ways of saying what the here and now is, and sometimes these lists help us. And the three marks reflect the nature of existence. They are conditions that are universal and thus are a mark of all things. Thich Nhat Hanh said that a mark is a basic element of existence. He says any teaching that does not bear these three marks cannot be said to be a teaching of the Buddha. And if you're wondering where this word seals comes from, Kogen Mizuno explains that seal is used in the sense of a brand that guarantees the validity of a document and serves as a person's mark. So any Buddhist theory must conform to these three seals to be true and genuine. These three things are present in all the teachings of the Buddha. So what are the three marks? They are impermanence, no self, and suffering. Although there is another interpretation of the third one, which I will talk about later. Impermanence, no self, and suffering. So at first glance may sound a little grim. Nothing lasts, I'm not really here, and to the extent I am here, I'm suffering. So, sorry, that's Buddhism. But, you know, there's another side to it. And I think this teaching in a lot of ways presents us with the exact opposite. I mean, I think this is the path of joy. I think Buddhism is about recognizing the hard realities of our conditions as human beings. And in doing that, in being direct and honest about that, we learn how to live in this world with authenticity. We're not pretending it's otherwise. We know how it is, and we're going forward based on these deep truths that we see. We embrace the worst of it. We look directly at it. And in doing that, we find our joy and our strength. And as I've said before, sometimes we find that the very thing that seemed to be the most grim can end up being the source of our strength. So when we're taking the Buddha's path, when we're at our best, I think we find we're on a path that tells us no lies. We're on a path, it is not the path of superficial happiness. It's much deeper than all of the little things we do to keep ourselves entertained or keep ourselves distracted or to kill the pain. There's something about looking honestly at impermanence, no self, and suffering that allows us to live in an open manner, to stop running from or denying or masking these things. It allows us to live with an open heart, to be alive to what is going on right here, right now. There's a soft rain outside. There's liberation in that. And it's deep. You may have come here at Zen Center for the first time, if you can remember the first time you came here. Maybe it's today. Maybe it was 40 years ago. Maybe you came here out of idle curiosity, but I think probably you had an inkling that there was going to be something deep here, and probably something difficult as well, and that may have drawn you. And I've heard people say so many times, some variation on this thought, they will say, you know, I've been walking by this place for years. I walk around the lake, or I ride my bike around the lake, and I've always thought I should stop in, and well, today I finally did. Or you might, I heard someone say once, you know, I think I drove by Zen Center 3 times before I came in. You know, like they just wanted to drive by. They weren't quite ready yet. They were working up to it. They were working up to it. So why is that? Why does it sometimes take people 2 or 5 or 10 years to get to the point where they're ready to come here? I remember first being fascinated by Zen centers and monasteries when I was about 18. It took me about 20 years before I actually walked into such a place. What is it that keeps us away for so long? I think it's ourselves. I think we know that if we're going to take this seriously, we're going to go inside and we're going to see what's there, and that is no small matter. That's what happens. They put you in front of the wall, so you're facing the wall, and there's nowhere to run. There you are. You're alone with yourself. And we say, you are Buddha. You are Buddha. We have a Buddha statue on the 3rd floor. That statue is a kind of reminder. The Buddha, to me, is not someone you can pray to who is going to come and help you. You are Buddha. You find the Buddha within. And that's what scares us, and that's what draws us. And we know that when we're ready for it, there is this great adventure to be had. And I've had many adventures in my life, but never as great an adventure as I've had just sitting on my cushion and going inside and seeing what's happening there. So, yeah, we look at the grim reality. We give up some of our personal control over the situation. We accept what is. That allows us to find the real joy. Ultimately, we share that joy with others. We learn how to draw that joy out of people, and we allow other people to draw that joy out of us. And we find that we can give up the fight where we're trying to make things permanent, the fight where we're trying to always convince ourselves that we have a separate self, the fight where we always try to protect our ego, and the fight where we try to deny that there is suffering. We just give up the fight. These things are true. Okay, let's live with this reality now. Let's stop fighting. So I'm going to talk about each of these 3 marks, and the first one is impermanence. What does impermanence mean? It means that everything changes. There is nothing to hang on to. And I'm going to illustrate this with just a little bit of a story. As some of you know, because I've talked about it before, when I was younger, I did some construction work, and I used to work on building grain elevators. This was about 40 years ago. And I think about 3 weeks ago, Kath and I got away for a little vacation, and we went to Northwest Iowa, and we visited some of those grain elevators that I built a long time ago. And I can't believe that Kathy enjoys doing this with me. But she does. We've done it before. You know, we go to these little small towns, and we talk to people, and we take photographs, and sometimes the people who work at the elevator will come out, and we talk to them about what's going on. Like right now, for instance, a lot of trucks are coming in because the farmers are emptying out their bins on their farms to make room for this season's harvest. Some of them are bringing in wet corn, some are bringing in dry corn. I found it pretty interesting, but you know, I'm into agriculture. Not everyone is. Yeah, we take photographs, and I actually brought one in. I know you can't, most of you won't be able to see this very well, but if you're interested, you could come up and look at it later. So this is a photograph of an elevator in Everly, Iowa, and it's a really beautiful elevator. It's got four tanks. I think it's about 120 feet high, and you can see all of the finish marks, these horizontal stripes, which some of which I think I put there, working on a little scaffold and brushing wet cement, so it looks really, really pretty. And so Kathy took this photo, and I'm going to hang it in my office at home. So these elevators are made of cement and steel, and they're enormous. You can see them from 5 miles away. And they seem pretty permanent. They're pretty solid. But I was really quite surprised to see how in 40 years, with the exception of this one, how much they had changed and really begun to deteriorate. It's surprising what happens to cement in 40 years. And there's steel sticking out now, and so you get these brown stripes from the rust, and the patches are more visible, and they just look kind of beat up. They're still solid. They still work. They may still work for another 50, 60 years. I don't know. But they're fading away already, cement and steel. Everything fades away. Even rocks fade away, and eventually the rocks are all going to be gone. Eventually our planet is all going to be gone. Another thing that is really impermanent about these elevators is my memory of them. And I've got a pretty good memory, but things are starting to fade from 40 years ago. I told Kathy there was an elevator in Primgar that I built, and we went there, and there was no elevator in Primgar. I think I got it mixed up with Paulina, so then we went there. And actually, this picture here, you know, this one still looks really great. It looks so great that I've got a slight doubt as to whether I actually did this one 40 years ago. I'm about 5% uncertain. And that kind of bothers me. You know, the ego part of me does not like that doubt. It wants to eliminate the doubt. And I was thinking maybe I might look in some old newspaper archives or something, and I might find an old picture of this as it's being built and draw myself in there with a Sharpie. just to protect my ego, which is important. But it also helps to understand impermanence if we look at our resistance to it, you know. And when things are really good, of course, we don't want them to change. We want it to stay good, and we do our best to hang on to it. And that makes sense if doing our best to hang on to it means continuing to do the work of being present in the moment. But when that becomes, kind of denial and wishful thinking, like, I don't like the way it is now, but I'm just going to keep going forward, asking why it can't be as good as yesterday, and trying to make it like yesterday, so that we're really separated from today, then that becomes problematic. We're using yesterday's wisdom to confront today's very different reality. Yesterday's wisdom is great if it's combined with today's reality. But if yesterday's wisdom is combined with denial of today's reality, it's very problematic. If only we can just accept the change instead and say, hey, yeah, the good stuff might be going away. Let's see what that's like. There it goes. Wow. Well, what's next? And then we're back in our reality instead of our wishful thinking. instead of longing for the previous reality. So impermanence, life itself is impermanent. This is the big fact that we carry around every day and that we often try to avoid. So how do we live in a world like this, where everything is impermanent? Our culture seems to encourage us just to deny this impermanence. We don't talk that much about death. Sometimes our attitudes toward death seem to be more about reassuring ourselves than about sort of facing the ultimate facts. But in Buddhism, we try to see all of this clearly. We know that everyone goes away in the end. It's harsh, but it's true. But if we face this clearly, we don't expect things to stay the same, to be other than they are. We accept impermanence on a deep level. We don't need things to be a certain way in order for us to be happy. We get beyond liking and disliking. Instead of judging reality as good or bad, we simply investigate it. And it's a great adventure, and we are so curious and open and so ready for the next thing because we're not hanging on to the last thing. And we do this through Zazen. That's how we learn to do it. We do it through Zazen, ritual, mindfulness, practice. So you can be right here moment to moment. You can accept change moment to moment. You stop hanging on. That's the key. Because it's not impermanence that makes us suffer. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, without impermanence, life could not be. It's our resistance to impermanence that makes us suffer. But that also means we can be free. We can't change impermanence, but we can change our resistance to it. So the second mark is no self. It's a little harder to grasp, I think, than impermanence. We all know that things change, and we can understand that, but no self. Does that really mean I'm not here? Well, obviously, in a sense, we are really here. This body and mind are real. But where I get into trouble is if I put too much emphasis on myself, too much emphasis on Ted, as some unchangeable, permanent entity separate from the rest of reality. No self in Buddhism is tied in with the idea that everything does exist interdependently. Nothing exists independently. Everything exists interdependently. It's something we get an inkling of sometimes in meditation or in mindful activity or anything we do that gets us in touch with a deeper meaning. But I'm going to use an example that might help. I'm going to talk about my robe, my priest's robe, as kind of an analogy. So my robe, which looks like this rakusu here, except it's much larger and I can wrap it around me, is made up of cloth and thread. And it's a separate identifiable thing, right? You can't deny that it's a robe. You can hold it. It's a thing. Unless you look at it very carefully and ask just what makes it a robe. When did it become a robe? When did it cease to become its separate elements and become a thing in itself? Was it when I put the last stitch in? Was it when I tied off that last stitch? Was it when I cut the tie? Or was it when I sighed? Huh, how about that? Or was it a robe already when it was done except for the edges, because it was big enough to wrap around me then? Or maybe when the first two pieces were sewn together? Or maybe when it was still strips of cloth and a spool of thread? Or maybe it was when Buddha and Ananda were out walking in the fields one day, and the Buddha said, I think those rice fields provide us with a nice pattern that we can fashion our robes after. So robe is an artificial construction in our minds. We're taking a confluence of things, cloth, thread, efforts, planning, the Buddhist institutional structure, and all of these things are coming together. And They come together at what particular point? That's the question. Is there a particular point? You really can't find one. And it's the same with the self. I like to think of myself as Ted, and that's helpful in many contexts. But I'm a confluence of things physically. You know, I have the genes from my ancestors. I have the things I take in, like food and water and sunlight and emotional support. When does the food become part of Ted and cease to be a separate object? Is it when it enters my mouth? Is it when I begin to digest it? Is it when it enters my bloodstream? And when did I become Ted? Was it when I received my name? Was it when I was born? Was it when I was conceived? Did I exist before I was conceived? I think maybe yes. Will I exist after I die? I think maybe yes. But the point is, it's all frayed around the edges. There really is no Ted, and there really is no robe. When we try to pin these things down, they are just not there. What we think of as a thing is just a process, a continuous process, and we're taking a little snapshot of that process and saying this is a thing. But that's a bit, that is an illusion for us. And then there's my personality. That's something we can really cling to, our sense of self. I have certain qualities I ascribe to myself, and I think that defines me. And I think that's fine. We all do that in order to function in the world. It gives us individuality. It gives us something to really love about each other, and it's wonderful. But it's only one aspect of things. I need to remember that I'm the result of and totally dependent upon forces outside of myself. I'm completely changeable. There is nothing to hang on to. In Buddhism, we talk about the five skandhas, the five aggregates: form, feeling, perception, formation, and consciousness. We use these five skandhas to weave a sense of self, but it's a fictional self, and I can let go of that. I can be free of this desperate attempt to cling to something that is not real. And when we see these things, no self, when we see no self, the impermanence thing is not so hard to take. We cultivate this letting go, and what comes in? Thusness. Things as they are. And when we're not so busy trying to constantly reinforce this idea that we are a separate existing thing, we can see the world, we can see it clearly. So the third mark is generally listed as suffering. But there is another view, and I think this is interesting. Suffering is pretty easy to understand, though we may try to deny it in many ways. We all know it exists. The first noble truth is the fact that there is suffering. Dukkha is a Sanskrit word that is often translated as suffering. It's often been pointed out that that's not really a great translation, because dukkha encompasses all kinds of things, from physical pain, chronic discomfort, not getting what we want, the suffering of knowing that things are impermanent, what Steve Hagen calls the basic human problem, not being able to comprehend the whole of it. All of these things are part of dukkha. And sometimes the first noble truth is stated in English as life is suffering. And I think this is very problematic, because life is not only suffering. And Thich Nhat Hanh, in the heart of the Buddha's teaching, talks about how many Buddhists have put forth the view that life is only suffering. And so there's no point to celebrating joy, because it's just going to turn to suffering. Joy is an illusion. Only suffering is real. And he says that only 100 years after the Buddha's death, some practitioners were getting together, and they kept repeating this thing, this formula: this is suffering, life is suffering, everything is suffering. And they thought they had to do that in order to really realize the truth. But Thich Nhat Hanh disagrees with this very much. He says life is not only suffering, and he prefers to say that the third mark of existence is nirvana. meaning nirvana, meaning not so much sort of this heavenly thing we might picture with nirvana, but he's talking about the ground of existence. He's talking about the joy of completely extinguishing our ideas and concepts. You might say that he's saying the third mark is not suffering, but actually its opposite, joy. And he's talking about a deep kind of joy here, a kind of quiet joy that happens. And he describes it in his discussion, looking at his book here. He says, imagine a meeting in which everyone is stating their own opinions and disagreeing with everyone else's. After the meeting is over, you are exhausted by these ideas and discussions. Anyone ever go to a meeting like that? Maybe. You open the door and go out into the garden where the air is fresh, the birds are singing, the wind is whistling in the trees. Life out here is quite different from the meeting with its words and anger. In the garden, there are still sounds and images, but they are refreshing and healing. Nirvana is not the absence of life. There's this wonderful term, Drishta Dharma Nirvana, which means nirvana in this very life. Nirvana means pacifying, silencing, or extinguishing the fire of suffering. Nirvana teaches that we already are what we want to become. We don't have to run after anything anymore. We only need to return to ourselves and touch our true nature. When we do, we have real peace and joy. So, when we talk about extinguishing suffering, that may be a little problematic. I think it's useful in a practical sense. I prefer the view that nirvana and samsara are the same. We don't need to transcend suffering. But instead, we can think of suffering and non-suffering not as two opposing forces, but as two sides of the same thing. So there is nirvana, the ground of all existence, which is beyond all of those concepts. So if we're choosing a scheme here, which of these, which to say nirvana or suffering, we kind of have a choice. We can say that suffering is the ground of human existence, or we can say that nirvana, which is beyond concepts of suffering and not suffering, is the ground of existence. And this allows for joy. The joy that we know is real because we've all felt it, because we can sit on the bench here in the backyard and feel the breeze coming from the lake and look at our beautiful grounds here, or we can be quietly working in the kitchen preparing food for our Dharma brothers and sisters here, or we can be on the front porch folding brochures or something like that. We know all of these things. We know joy, and we know what love is like. So to sum up, impermanence, no self, and nirvana, which is the ground of all existence, are the three things that have to be present in order for a teaching to be a genuine teaching of the Buddha. And I just would like to say one more brief thing, which is that I've talked about going to the difficult places, and I talk about that a lot. And I know that it's not so easy sometimes to do this practice. And sometimes even if you're not seeking out the difficult places, they come to you. That's why we have a lot of support here for people doing these practices. We have the support of the community. You can talk to your friends here. You can meet people here. You can talk about what practice is like for you. We have all of our programming where there are opportunities to talk and learn about practice. And we have a number of teachers here. And if you ever feel like you're wading into difficult waters and you would like a little guidance, you are most welcome to talk to a teacher. You contact one of the transmitted teachers and you ask if you could talk, and they are there for you. So I would encourage you to remember that. And that's what I have to say today about the three marks. Thank you very much for listening. And we have a few minutes here. Would anyone like to say anything or ask a question? Yes, Taras.
So one thing I've sort of been thinking about sort of like with no self, I also sort of think about it as changing self. So as you take and inhale, as you eat and drink, you know, something that wasn't you, in a sense, becomes you.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to the bathroom, when you exhale, when you clip your nails and hair, something that was you becomes not you. So sort of, it's like a changing boundary sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But in our language, you know, we say I, you, me, mine, yours. So it's kind of hard to get around, at least with English.
Yeah.
The idea of independent beings, but at the same time, they're constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Think of it as changing self. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Yes?
I was loving this analogy of the water and the waves.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that and how that relates to that? Is that more about
this? Yeah, Raymond, could I see the program here? No, that's fine. Yeah, yeah, I chose this because it was about nirvana. It elaborated on that a little bit. And it says, a wave doesn't have to die in order to become water. Water is the substance of the wave. The wave is already water. We are like that. We carry in us the ground of interbeing, nirvana, the world of no birth and no death, etc. I really love that, you know. We're the wave and we think we're different from the water, but we're the water and it's okay. And we think that nirvana is this thing that's outside of us that we couldn't possibly realize. But we're already there. We're already there. We just have to let it be, you know? Just letting go of the concepts, letting go of all of the classifications and all of the mental activity. It's here right now. It's here right now. And we can learn to do that. We can become more and more quiet. More and more quiet. Keep doing this practice. And of course we have setbacks and things get loud again. But we can come back again. We can come back again and again. And there's no hurry. We've got lots of time. So we can just keep at this and just let it be. It's like the rain out here. It's just rain. Yes?
I have a question. You talk about pain and suffering, and I understand letting go. What about when I know someone and I feel in that point too, if you have physical pain, and it doesn't go away. So when you meditate, you know, obviously when you're present, all what you feel is, you know, what you feel is your pain. So how do you get out of it? I mean, you know it's supposed to get out of it, but it's pretty difficult to live in a constant pain.
Yes.
9 or 10, you know, let's say 7, 8 or 9.
Yes, and I would not say that the problem is your resistance to the pain. The pain is very real, you know, and sometimes I say things in kind of an extreme way to make a point. Physical pain is a fact. You cannot make it go away. You can work with your resistance to it and maybe diminish it somewhat, but it's a fact. It is something that we have to work with, and it's important in our practice, in our sitting practice, to really take care of our pain and not make it worse. So, is there more you'd like to say about that?
Well, I guess in a way, I mean, distracting your mind from the pain, assuming, I mean, and because there's nothing you can do about it, seems to be helpful.
Mm-hmm. It can be.
At some point in time, it goes to your mental capacities too, because all that you feel is food.
Right, right.
I know I'm a little bit stuck with the Buddhist philosophy, as it really doesn't give a clear answer, because the pain is there, and it's, I mean, you can let go of things, emotion things, and attachment, blah, blah, blah. That's all fine, but the physical pain, when you're constantly in physical pain, it's really difficult to get out of that.
Right.
Get out of it, or what you feel is pain.
I think that's a very good point, and I talk a lot about going toward the pain, and you know, generally as a way to practice, that is good advice, but it is not always true. going toward physical pain. Sometimes you do need a distraction. Sometimes it's the very best thing. Sometimes if you have sort of some kind of mental agony, some trauma or something, you don't want to go toward it all at once. You have to go toward it very carefully. Sometimes distracting yourself from it is the right thing to do. So it's very important that we use wisdom to know how and when to do this. And that's one reason I talked about working with a teacher at the end of my talk, because teachers can pick up on the subtleties of a given situation, I think, and give pretty good guidance about these things. So, thank you for your question. Yes?
So, I just want to make a comment. I've been what I'd call a book Buddhist my whole adult life.
Mm-hmm.
And long ago, intellectually, I accepted this idea of no self, no non-self. But I've always felt the desire at an experiential level to have a self. And desire, of course, means suffering. Okay? And it seems to me that Buddhism sort of pathologizes that in a way that's a problem. Because evolution has created us with this sense of having a self and this consciousness of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so somehow that's been helpful in an evolutionary sense. And I think this desire to have a self and the suffering that that causes is just a byproduct of that. And I think there would be, for me, that's where compassion comes in. That it's a natural state to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's an unfortunate byproduct of our evolutionary state. So that's my comment.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you. Yes?
Tyrus, I was just thinking about what you were saying. I remember Ben saying once how his yoga teacher had referred to when giving direction to move body parts, instead of saying your or yours, that she would say move the hand or the arm or the leg or the foot. And so I've been... your talk brought kind of that up, and what Tara said about referring to parts of my body as the instead of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And that helping me to have like less attachment over this, you know, over
mm-hmm.
the desire of it to be like my hairstyle and my, you know, my face. That's it's been a helpful English tool for me.
Yeah, yeah.
In Spanish, it already exists.
Yes, exactly. You're right.
Okay. All right, well, I think we should, at this point, turn it over to the Doan. Thank you all so much.